What's up, everybody? This is Carrick with ACG, and welcome to the ACG&D podcast. Rolling natural 20s all the time. This is a podcast about tabletop gaming, about video games, about Dungeons and Dragons, any kind of role-playing game and how they all mix together. We sort of jump around. Hell, there'll be discussions about movies and music, as long as it all some way connects back to role-playing. And today we're going to talk about a bunch of different stuff. We're going to talk about the top five worlds that I actually like. These are not the rule sets, but the worlds themselves. This is something that I did a little bit differently in the past in another podcast, but I want to revisit that today. We're going to be talking about initiative and how that impacts the way a dungeon master, game master, role master, referee, or the players themselves, if it's some kind of alternating GM system, have to handle those things. And we'll be talking about more. I would love for you to share this if you can. This is a podcast that, unfortunately, due to events beyond my control, I haven't been able to return to for the last 2 or 3 weeks due to personal issues. I'm finally back in and trying to get back up on my feet. So if you can, I would really appreciate you spreading this around, posting it in different places, Reddits that have to do with role playing, maybe podcasts, what have you. Let's begin. What are these about usually? Well, they're about us sitting down and talking about Dungeons and Dragons, about Rifts, about World of Darkness, about Forgotten Realms, about Ravenloft. It doesn't matter. It doesn't matter the rule system. It doesn't matter the world. It's about role-playing. In fact, we'll be talking about tabletop a little bit today as well. It's for us to sit down and sort of try to pick a little bit of enjoyment out of the absolute hypocrisy and disaster that the current world is in. And today, I want to talk about the top five worlds as I grew up when I was a kid and what I liked. And this is going to be very short. Actually, it's going to be the top four, with the fifth being, what is yours? I want to know what yours is, and we'll discuss yours. And the winner, the one that I see the most responses of, again, you can easily respond by using the hashtag ACGND in Twitter, and you can respond with what your favorite world and fiction is. It doesn't have to be the rules. It can be the fiction itself. That's sort of what we're going with right now. And we'll talk about it. I'll bring it up in the next podcast. My top five. First, I want to talk about Dragonlance for a second. Dragonlance is 1980s, 1990s. And it looks like Margaret Weis and Tracy Hickman are in some way revisiting it currently. Now, these were originally fictions written around the modules, the game system that was actually occurring at TSR at the time. There was a game, a D&D game, that was going on with some of the writers, and this turned into a story. In fact, there's a very cool story about how Raistlin, depends on how you pronounce that character's name. I'll pronounce it Raistlin. How that character actually came about, which was where everybody got together and one of the playtesters slash writers slash game designers appeared in the game with them and decided to play a very whispery style of magician, of magic user. And it turned into Raistlin, one of the most popular magic users in really all of D&D. I mean, up there with, you know, Elminster, if you consider that, up there with, in all honesty, maybe not Gandalf in that way, but certainly high enough that you see tons of merchandise with him, and you hear some of the bigger people who've grown up in that time talk about it, even in some of the larger podcasts. So it was very cool. The reason why I like Dragonlance is because it still hinges a little bit more on the romantic Dungeon and Dragon style worlds, the romantic fantasy style worlds. Now, what do I mean by that? Well, later as things went on, you get your Warhammer or fantasy roleplay, which I adore, but it's gritty, right? It's dark. It's magic users are more hedge wizards. And if they have a ton of power, it's usually at the unfortunate hand of chaos or something like that, to where it's cool. It's a little bit grittier. You could even say it's more realistic for a magic using game. But what it actually is a little bit of a grayer style. And with Dragonlance, it was still that romantic style. Heroes could still be heroes, and you could still have moments of just sheer brilliance and magic without retconning. This is something that I've noticed with larger fantasy games, even those on Twitch, as well as just a lot of times with various different games, where there's always that desire that if somebody has an overt, hugely magical moment, there has to be some kind of absolute return on that, a ratcheting back almost of karma, where it slams them down. And what happened with some of these fantasy worlds is it was more along the lines of one or two people would be incredibly powerful, not a huge number of them. And in fact, the magic using schools that existed in Dragonlance really ended up working this out. So basically what they did is if you were very high skilled at magic, you took the tests of high sorcery. And if you failed those tests, you couldn't continue to use magic because you basically couldn't fit into the schooling. And so you were sort of a renegade at that point. In fact, not sort of, that's what you were. And you could learn magic, but it was considered a very dark art at that point. Where, if you stuck in there, you were in sort of the dogmatic style of magic, and you chose a color of robes to indicate if you were, let's say, selfish or giving, that kind of thing, your white robes, your red robes, and your black robes. And changing in the way each character went, this was really an alignment switch. It wouldn't make a lot of sense because day to day, you might change your robes three times depending on what choices you make. That's the way real people work. But what worked for a lot of people with this in particular is it allowed for them to understand what their magic users were sort of about at a time when alignment didn't really necessarily always fit. But sometimes when it came to the way you wanted to use your magic, there was more of an overarching. And funny enough, I've talked about nature and demeanor in a weird way. You could almost say the alignment was possibly the nature of those magic users at the time, and the demeanor, at least for a while, would be those robe colors. You could also switch it if you wanted. But anyway, Dragonlance, one of my favorite. They definitely lived in the pyramid style of gameplay mechanics. You're good, you're evil, you're neutral. They had the same thing with almost all of their groups, whether it be the magic users or the knights, which had your Knights of the Crown, your Knights of the Rose, and your Knights of, let's see, it was Crown and Rose, and there was one other. But they were all sort of in this trinity. That was one of the things that you could definitely tell is more of an old school, more of the romantic style of gaming. The next up is Rifts. It's just a fantastic world, guys. I've talked about the rules, but if you guys get a chance, Savage Worlds has taken on the Rifts world on the side. So Rifts is still going, but they've taken it on and they've moved it into the Savage World kind of gameplay system, which, you know, that's hit and miss because I'm not a huge fan of Savage Worlds, but I know a lot of people are. But that allows you to jump into Rifts without worrying about the shit Palladium rules. And Rifts is incredible. Rifts is basically every single thing you can imagine in one game. And that's the honest truth. Everything from sword-wielding D&D character style stuff to androids to Atlantis, right? All mixed together because of ley lines in the world exploding with magical power when a war happened and it opened up dimensional gateways. If you get a chance, check it out. It is certainly absolutely an inspiration for my own game that's now been going for 25 years with my same people. So Rifts is just incredible. The next up is World of Darkness. I'm going to be very short on this because I want to be short on this entire opening section because I really am doing this more along the lines to get your own ideas, but to prime them with some of mine. World of Darkness, I've talked about before with the Weaver, the Wild, and the Worm. One of the reasons why, if you noticed, two of these, if not technically three, use a trinity kind of situation. So the Weaver, the Wild, and the Worm, three, right? And technically you could consider their main races, which would be the vampires, the werewolves, and the magic users as the three. And then you break off from those, usually with another three. That's just what happens narratively in sort of an organic way where people want to go good, bad, and the ugly, but really the good, bad, and the neutral, right? And that sort of happened and sort of works for a lot of people, that idea of an offset, the oddness. In fact, we see it in video games where a lot of video games used to be co-op, right? And then they went to four player. That was a big deal. And now you're seeing the reason why you're seeing a prevalence of three player or five player games is because the odd style allows for the inability for you to balance negative and positive, or let's say aggression and defense perfectly. You always are going to have an offset, a 3-2 defense kind of thing. You're always going to have an offset there. And it makes for, I think for a lot of people, a more technically varied world. And you definitely saw that in World of Darkness. You had your magic users and your vampires and your werewolves who all believed in the same gods. They all knew or generally identified with these kind of, you know, almost cult Cthulhu style creatures, but each one of them saw them in a different way, and you never quite knew which one was right. And that was one of the best parts. It was really only right depending on which character you were. If you were the magic users, of course, it made sense. Everything worked the way you expected, so you would assume that you were right. Vampires and werewolves all the same. But what I'd like to know is what's yours? Because as I get to my last one, this is a varied one. This was brought up by somebody in the Discord. I want to know what yours is. So again, ACGND, hashtag You know, give me the favorite world that you enjoy. Let's say if you haven't done role-playing, but you've read a bunch of books and you would love to have a role-playing game in that. Maybe there's one, you haven't got to experience it. Feel free to throw that in. Mine is, and the last one, number four, Ravenloft. So what is Ravenloft? Ravenloft came about after, you know, a great deal of success on TSR's part. But basically, Ravenloft is your classical horror movies turned into a game world. Barovia is the game world. Now, some things have changed, so I'm going to explain to you the more classical Ravenloft. Some things may have changed due to the rules. But basically, what Ravenloft had was it had a series of lords that were supernatural-style creatures. In fact, Strahd, who's the main evil guy, is your very typical Dracula slash vampire leader, and each one came in. And in fact, there was a crossover event in Dragonlance. Lord Soth, who is an undead knight, who was a major opponent in all of the Dragonlance stories, ended up being pulled into Ravenloft and given his own land. Now, why would that matter? Because Ravenloft is a dimensional land. It's not necessarily a planet like you would think of a lot of worlds. It's major land, Barovia, but its major world basically extends and shrinks as leaders grow in power and come and go. So when Soth was pulled by the mists into this other world, these mists can go into the Dragonlance world. They can actually pull characters from other worlds. It pulled Lord Soth into this world and gave him the power of a land. It actually built a land around him, and then people end up coming to live in those lands because there are normal people, and there's definitely the gypsy archetypes that are in there that are in your original, you know, horror movies as well. But it's very cool because in Ravenloft, what happens is the world itself basically loves sorrow. So to give you an example, Strahd ends up basically the love of his life dies, and the world repays him in sorrow by continually or occasionally having people born that look like her, and he ends up, you know, causing their deaths, all that kind of stuff. He's a major villain in the Strahd Castle event that you can do in D&D, or I can't remember the exact name. I think it's called Castle Ravenloft, in fact. So Ravenloft is a world, Barovia, of course, as his land itself, but just all these different lands coming and going, being able to go into other worlds was so incredible. And they had sort of an obscure death rule that continued from Dragonlance, Forgotten Realms, and certainly is in Ravenloft, where when a character dies, a major enemy dies, that kind of stuff, usually it's built a little bit around an obscure death rule where they can always come back. Like they fall off a cliff and their body can't be found, right? And they come back. And that's what's happened a couple times with Strahd. I think it happened one time with Lord Soth. I could be wrong on that. But Ravenloft, just incredible, really weird, very gothic. I really liked it. So again, I'd like to know yours. The next talking point on this is going to be about initiative. Initiative is crazy difficult. Now, you may be thinking, difficult is not that difficult for me. I will say that whenever I'm teaching somebody any kind of rule system, or whenever you're getting together with people to discuss, initiative is where a lot of discussion ends up revolving around, because a lot of times a plus to this or a negative to this is very easy for a person to understand, but initiative is not. Let me explain to you why. Technically, there's two variations on initiative with 1,000 other variations as you continue to expand them. We're going to talk about the major two. What is initiative in the first place? Initiative is really who goes first. If you get five people against five people, let's skip that. Let's say you have a football game. Quarterback goes first. If he doesn't, it's technically some kind of penalty, right? You know, there's certain activities that you can do, but most of the time, quarterback, and in fact, you would even say the center goes first, hiking the ball. And the quarterback can then go and everybody else can go after them. And everybody else goes at a slightly different speed, but they look like one universal whole. Now, we see this in other games like Cyanide's Blood Bowl games, where you can choose to do real time. You can choose to do a system where basically everybody decides what they're going to do and then it plays out in real time, almost like a synchronous kind of situation. Or you can go one at a time depending on initiative. We're going to talk about the two major types, which is one at a time, as well as everybody deciding what they're going to do and then the group going at once. And there's a reason for this. So when you come to initiative, let's say you make a character, and depending on the different game worlds, you have a dex bonus maybe for your character, which is always a little bit weird to me because dexterity is not always the quickest way somebody can do anything. In fact, the brain still has to figure out what you want to do. So perception in some game worlds is actually a lot that has to do with initiative, or they're combined. Let's say you get the average of both for your, so maybe you're playing a game where you have 5 perception, which is your top, and werewolf or something like that, and you have 2 in dexterity. You would take 1/2 of each, you'd add them together, and that'd be your bonus to indicate your ability to not only think on your feet instantly, but also actually do those things. Because a lot of people can notice a punch coming towards their face. It's just that their body is screaming for them to do something, and the nerve clusters just, hey, they ain't getting that signal quick enough. So you have 2 types of initiative. You have the type where everybody goes in and they roll, or in some way there is a ladder created. Carrick goes first because his initiative is the highest. His initiative, let's say, is 15. Next person's is 12. Next person's is 8, and we go down. Or if you do it in reverse, person has a 3, they're the highest. Next person has an 8, they're the next highest. Then it's 12, 13, 14, 15, and everybody goes. Here's a problem with that initiative system that every DM runs into at some point. If you have everybody going and fulfilling all of their actual attacks and roles and situations like that, technically you're breaking the initiative right away. Let me describe. So let's say you've got Carrick. He's got a 5 initiative. He's the fastest. We're going to go for the least, the better. No, we'll switch around. We'll go with the most, the better. So let's say he's got a 20 initiative. He's got the best initiative in the group, and he's going to go first. And there's Dexter. Dexter's just standing there doing nothing, smoking a cigarette. Carrick's going to punch him. Carrick goes first. Carrick rolls his attack. However, boom. Now, what happens? Well, in a lot of games, Dexter would be able to roll all of his systems, defenses, special moves, actions, activities, and actually skip ahead in many ways in the initiative pool to do all those things. That's one weird break. And there's a lot of systems that work around this. I'm not saying there aren't. There's some systems that basically state, you know, you can only do these specific things on, some kind of defense against a punch, or you just get punched. You can't do anything. You know, there's all this kind of stuff. Maybe the only way you can truly defend yourself is if you have a skill or are already equal to the initiative of somebody else. There's various different ways you can do that. But what also happens in a tit-for-tat kind of initiative system is a big immersion breaker for a lot of players. Let's say you have 2 people going first, and they're both going to attack the same guy. So you have Carrick and you have Bill. Carrick and Bill are going to attack Dexter. Carrick kicks Dexter and knocks him down. But Bill has already, because of how he's built his initiative, decided what he's going to do. How does Bill react to that? Now you have multiple systems where Bill tells the DM prior what he's going to do. In fact, we have a lot of systems that are like that, where it's sort of a round robin, where everybody's like, hey, this is what I'm going to do. And then boom, you sort of figure it out. And it doesn't mean they're going at the same time. It just means everybody knows. However, what can occur in that point is that Bill can technically appear to have a much higher initiative, much higher intelligence, much higher perception than anybody else in the room, because not only does he get to change his attack style when Carrick knocks this guy down, but he also gets to change, hell, maybe multiple things that he does in the game world in that spot prior to Dexter. And that can be one of the major reasons why balancing is such a problem in a lot of battle games, in a lot of games with a lot of combat, because there's always these pluses and minuses and tit for tat, and it's difficult to figure out exactly what it is. It's difficult to really engage in those games and understand the difference between, let's say, a normal attack, a normal boxer, let's say, and a counterpuncher, where a counterpuncher technically has probably slightly faster reaction time than the actual person attacking. Not always, but maybe. And so you have this difference. Now, a lot of games will have all kinds of rules based around this. And this is to indicate just how difficult it can be, because a lot of them will have rules around it. And they'll be like, hey, man, so if you're doing this defense, it's +2 to your initiative right when you're doing it. It's this, it's that, it's blah, 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 blah. Sometimes old style systems would not only have that, but they would give you a temporary initiative. So I get knocked down, or Carrick knocks down Dexter, and Bill now has some kind of temporary initiative that is right at the level of Carrick's, because he gets to decide what he wants to do now that his attack has changed, right? And that doesn't even include people who attack twice. Have you guys played those games where somebody's like, yeah, you have 2 attacks. You've got your normal attack and your normal initiative, and then you can do a second attack unaided in all ways right at the end. I got to tell you, that shit is I'm not saying it's broken. It's a system that is created and has been used and utilized because there's not a good, perfect way around this kind of stuff. But if you actually break it down and look at it logically, this is one of the reasons why tabletop game players who play D&D a lot of times, or role-playing games, can have a lot of difficulties understanding what's going on. Because they're like, I don't understand, man. This guy got to do all this stuff. I get to attack in my normal turn, but then I also have attack right at the end. Dude, technically, that's insanely powerful because it's not just win. It's all the stuff that's happened in between and the information that has been gleaned by my character at the very end. And some people will be like, oh, well, it's because he's fast. No. Matter of fact, multiple games do not actually separate somebody who is super fast from getting two attacks and somebody who maybe has a weapon where they get one attack at the starting and one attack unaided. But let's switch over. And of course, I will try to help you work out some of these things as we move forward. But let's talk about the other type of initiative, which is your team initiative, which is where basically team one goes and then team two goes. Now, that's an even bigger issue, I think, for a lot of people, because that's really difficult for the GM. And in fact, I would say a lot of people move over to a miniatures style base when they run into these kind of situations, when it runs into initiative. In fact, I would tell you, most of the time I talk to people, the where am I comes up far less than you would expect when it's involving the attacks, other than flanking, you know, that kind of stuff certainly will come up. But a lot of times people already know that they're flanking or know that they're behind people. Do you know where that comes up a lot? It comes up when it adjusts their initiative. When it comes up when they're higher on a sandbar and they get a higher initiative, which, by the way, there are multiple games that do that kind of stuff, that add things to your initiative that really don't make a lot of sense. Again, for tabletop players coming in, this is going to be quite confusing because to a tabletop player, they go on a grid style system and it's not better in any way, shape or form. It's just simply that usually those rules are a little bit more clarified because a tabletop game usually has one or two or three, maybe five, 10 things you can do, abilities you can do. And it's like a video game. When you run out, you're done. Let me give you a real quick example. When you're playing Maximum Apocalypse, which is a really good kickstarted game, when you're playing that, you have a couple free moves, and then you have a couple moves that count as one of your four that you normally have. And what ends up happening is, well, does the free move happen before this? Can I do the free move? If I do this move, it involves half of the, you know, some of the free move. Is it all a free move? That kind of stuff. Can I do this prior to this? Can I move, you know, can I take a weapon out of my backpack? And you get a lot of those games where they're like, oh, taking a weapon out of your backpack, that doesn't affect your initiative. It's considered a free action. That, again, they're not bad things. I'm just pointing out why initiative is so troublesome and why I'm really surprised that for the most part, you rarely hear people talking about it. And the reason why I think you rarely hear people talk about it is because there's probably not a good way to come out of this discussion without an amount of heat that's pretty high, because every game system, right, they're going to think they're the best. Every game system is going to be like, we perfectly handled this. I got to tell you, at least so far, no game has perfectly handled initiative. Initiative has to be decided and explained very well by the game master. And if it's a revolving GM style game, a storyteller game, it has to be decided prior. People really have to understand it. And it can't be too complex, because then you get this situation where minimaxing isn't minimaxing, of course, meaning, you know, making sure that you give up a great deal to really maximize something else. You're minimizing your intelligence when you're making a character so you can maximize your strength, that kind of stuff. But what, you know, how you're putting it all together and what you try to do. And this is another reason why a lot of, you know, games will go for more of a real-time kind of situation where they're like, all right, let's just, you know, let's do this. I've seen games, no lie, where there's a pad on the table. This was a house rule, which, by the way, I am not against. This was a house rule that we made up where it was a table. Everybody rolled a dice, and wherever the dice landed indicated a slight above or beyond plus to your initiative that you had, as well as a couple other things it added. Now you might be thinking, well, that's got no real, you know, connection to the character. That's absolutely true. Just like if you talk to a boxer, usually they'll say, man, I don't hear the corner. I don't hear anybody else. I don't hear those kind of things when they're boxing. And then some would be like, I hear everything. In a way, this role was sort of like for characters that were normal, where, you know, little things in the world could impact their initiative, whether it be the sound of a gunshot going off behind them and startling them during the attack or what have you. And I got to admit, those kind of things actually helped, because what happened was, you, instead of being dogmatic, you added a little bit of flexibility, a little bit of RNG in there. And that that actually helps. And I would suggest to you, if you're going into initiative and you're having, you know, some issues, you really should identify just how deep some of these pluses can go. Some games are better than others. Some games have cards. Some games are super detailed and you can just add bonuses and negatives on top of everything. But one of the things I've found is that there is a escalating system that I've seen used where basically you get your normal initiative plus any normal bonus. And then as you add bonuses, the chances go higher and higher of basically things sort of, I guess you would say, going wrong. Meaning at some point there, it's almost chaos for the human mind. And there's a higher chance of, you know, some negatives actually occurring. And I honestly got to say that was working quite well for us. The people that I was playing with, we haven't used it in a while. And I think I'm the only, no, there's one other person who's with me where we use that. But I sort of liked it because it was like, okay, the weapon is quick, so it gives you a plus one. Your perception is good, so you get a plus one from that. And your dexterity is good, so you get a plus one from that, if dexterity comes into it. So you've got a plus three to your initiative. No big deal. That's pretty acceptable, right? But let's say this person also has, you know, something above the quick draw, you know, whether it alert senses, right? And that's another two. And you're like, okay, so now they're at five. And at some point, depending on how a player plays and the skills they get, they may have fucking 50 points on there. They wouldn't have 50 points, but you get my drift. And so what was cool with this system was it was like, okay, no worries. The more skills, the more bonuses you try to add up, the higher the chance that basically things go a little bit wrong. And I thought that was very cool. I thought it was really enjoyable. In fact, I saw one system where it took the amount of percentage for perception you had, and that was the highest number of skills you could add. So if you had a percentage of three, you could only add three bonuses to your initiative. And I thought that was brilliant because to me, that just made sense. It also caused a person to really try to identify how they were going to train up their perception, what they were going to do. They were like, okay, I can really only capture three big bonuses in this thing, right? And again, this is just for initiative, not for attacks or anything like that. But I really liked that. And we've used it a couple times, and I think it's a good general house rule for a lot of players where, you know, they just say, okay, man, your perception, you know, and you could use it for other things and say, all right, whatever, how many ever points you have in perception. Again, I use World of Darkness because their system is less numbers than a lot of D20 or D100 games, but you can figure this out on your own for any other game. But what was nice here was perception. You know, if somebody's got a two, they're like, okay, that means I can add the gun, right? And I can add this other skill that gives me a plus three, and that's it. I can't add another one. Or maybe they're looking and they're like, I've got the gun. It's always going to add the plus one. Maybe that's sort of a given that you always have to use that one. But I have another skill that if I can talk the GM into allowing me to use it, not only gives me the same amount of points, but maybe gives me another weird bonus or maybe does something that makes sense for my character. Because there's a lot of people who talk about builds these days. And actually, I'll talk about builds in a second. I want to finish initiative. I'm going to stop and put a note down. All right, I wrote myself a note. So anyway, with initiative, I would say if you're getting confused by that, you can certainly feel free to reach out and ask anybody. But I would say with a lot of systems, the real reason why there's so many house rules now for so many different games is because it can just become a logistical nightmare that really slows down the game. And what I've found is if you have what I would consider almost realistic expectations for some of the things you can do, it can really add to the role playing. It can add to the role playing when you understand that your perception of the world around you just isn't high enough to add all these pluses without adding perception itself. And so what happens is you sort of make it so that the player has to think and go, okay, I really want to add strength, right? But if I do, that's only going to help me in those indications or those positions where I can use that, where with perception, if I raise it, I can possibly add some of these other skills in or get a gun or maybe two guns and they add plus one and plus one. You get my drift. Or they, you know, a pair of shoes called the Scootin' Booters where it adds a plus one. And I think that's great. I think that a lot more people need to embrace house rules. I just really do. I think that there's a dogmatic kind of thing that goes on right now. And man, have I seen it. I'll talk about this in a second, but I have seen a dogmatic fixation that is almost unhealthy on rule systems. And I don't know if you agree, but I got to tell you, man, just discussing rule systems can be a bitter travesty of a discussion when you're trying to say, hey, man, this is a little too much. And people go, oh, too much. What do you mean? So-and-so does it perfectly. And you just be like, okay, that's so-and-so. But I've got five guys who maybe get together once every 6 weeks. They don't have the time to memorize all this stuff. you know, what should we figure out? And I always say, you know, a couple house rules, man. A couple house rules work really well to keep your game going and moving forward. And I think initiative is one where a lot of people need to look at it and sort of make sure that they're understanding how everything works, because initiative can get out of control insanely quickly. I've even seen games where they're like, you only roll one initiative for the entire battle. And you're like, well, I mean, to me personally, I'm like, dude, that's pretty rough. You know, what if you say perception, you know, it, for each round, you know, maybe a person can do initiative until they're at, you know, until they can't roll a new initiative. So let's say if my perception is two, for two rounds, I get to roll initiative. And then from that point on, you know, I stick it at an initiative that I've rolled, you know, something like that. Because to me, the idea of just having the one initiative for the entire battle is like, damn. And I know that some games are like, you do have that one initiative, but then you can add some skills to it and adjust it. But that just doesn't make a lot of sense. I like it fluid, but easy to remember for gamers who want to come in and learn the system. So again, I would say if initiative is bothering you, look at how you're doing it. Are you doing it one-offs where each character has their own and they move about and all those bonuses are added? Are you doing it as a group? Which I think a lot of game players don't do it as a group anymore. But that was a big thing for a while, and it just mind-numbing. But regardless of which way you do it, maybe look at some rules that contain it but make sense realistically in your game. And of course, discuss this with your players. The next thing I want to discuss is So a little caveat here. I've been pretty honest that I wasn't going to do a D&D podcast for a long time, but multiple people were telling me just how bitter and caustic discussion can be about D&D, and they know that, especially for me, I'm pretty positive. I joke in reviews, but I would say for the most part, I actually like to be incredibly positive about stuff and try to work things out. And I actually sort of got talked into doing a D&D podcast. I mean, I wanted to, but it's like, it doesn't fit the channel. It's certainly not going to do well. And the more videos I post that don't do well, lowers the percentage of views you get, which can actually affect if you get a game review. But I'm like, you know what, man, I think I'll do this. And I got to tell you, and this is just me being honest, man. And I would love to hear from you if this is, you know, something you've dealt with, but the bitterness and toxicity around rules and deviations to rules in role-playing is insane. It is like the worst parts of an MMO ever. In fact, the worst interactions that I think I have ever had on Twitter or on any forums have been by some very popular D&D creators, inventors, what have you, and even stating that they are like being a jack-off will just get you destroyed. Like just a couple days ago, I was like, you know, I don't like to deal with this stuff because it's toxic. And people were mad at me. They were legitimately pissed. I got blocked by some people because I said that the groups were toxic. And that's one of the reasons why it was difficult for me to interact. And those people who, by the way, were some creators were actually blocking me. They were just like, oh, I'm just blocking this person. And I'm like, man, you guys are so enwrapped and so masturbatory over what you think is right or wrong. It's insane. And this can happen with builds. Builds are something I'm starting to see come up a lot where people are like, oh, I want to do this gunrunner build for this game. And they're sticking dogmatically to it. And I get the idea of why you're doing it. They're sort of letting the roles, the ROLLs, take over for the ROLE. And they get their, you know, they get their build. And then maybe they add the role playing, the theater part on top of that. But I got to say, man, I don't know about you. And we can certainly talk about this because I'm open to discussion about it, unlike apparently other people. But when it comes to builds, what I find is that it doesn't take very long before you can feel you're in a build. And if you're into that kind of game, most likely you probably came out of a game like Diablo or you came out of a, you know, video games, and a build to you makes sense. But I got to say, man, and I've said this before in the D&D podcast prior, my favorite thief was a thief who couldn't steal. Those kind of things to me are absolutely incredible. I've actually seen, which I can't believe that. I mean, this is, to me, is so weird, but I've seen it now where a lot of times when a person dies in a game, the only way for them to rejoin the game is to have a character that's exactly the same level as everybody else. And I'm like, what? Like, what? And they'll be like, oh yeah, that's because, you know, they can't even hit a dragon if they're low level. And I'm all, dude, to me, that's missing the very fantasy in which role playing is about, is that you can. How does the lowly level one keep up with the level fives and the 15s and the 20s if you do a level system? And how do they make themselves worthwhile and noticeable? Also, that would mean if you know that you can just die and come back at the same level as a different character, first of all, role-playing wise, that makes no fucking sense. If you're in a fucking desert and your dude dies, what are you gonna, I mean, like, who are you gonna find? You know, is some dude just gonna show up? Like, and I get it. Some people are more interested in just being like, yeah, we'll figure it out. But to me, the narrative matters. But additionally, it's like, I would think that the idea that there was a risk would matter more if you knew that coming back would at least have a negative of some kind. But instead, people are coming back. Like, I was watching one where, you know, somebody died and they were like level 12 or 15 or whatever. And they came back and it was like they just rolled up another character instantly. And they just sort of pretended that the other guy just disappeared. And it was so weird. It was so lacking. It was basically the worst parts of save scumming in video games I've ever seen. And I think with builds and the idea for builds causes a little bit of that. The idea that this is a particular build and I know how to get to this build. So if I die, I'm just going to rebuild this build to be the build that the build is the build that I like. And you're just like, what? Like, what? I guess I would just say, you know, as you can tell, I'm not a huge fan of builds, but I think if I was, and if you want to do builds, you know, rub a little dirt on there, man. It doesn't always have to be roll ROLE dirt either. And I think that that's the problem, is a lot of people get stuck thinking, I'll do a build a very particular way with these very particular pluses, but then I'll bring out the specialness in the role playing itself. And I got to say, for me, if you look at any movie, if you look at any book, if you look at any narrative, the hero isn't always the person who is the funniest or the smartest. They're not always the best swordsman. Many times they're the mix. They're the person who pulls it out when they shouldn't. They're the person who succeeds when you don't expect them to. And, you know, maybe I sound old, but, well, I thought I sounded old, but then I talked to a bunch of people in my Discord who were like, dude, thank God somebody mentioned this because we hate it. So, and they were super young. They were like 17. So I guess it's possible. But to me, I would just say with builds, if you're going into a build, you know, because it helps you, I think that's great and it absolutely should. But remember to rub a little dirt on it with maybe a different skill that you just never had thought of mixing together. In fact, I've seen people, and this comes up in video games a lot, where somebody's like, I can't believe I can't completely remove all my skill points and completely put them somewhere else. And I get it. Somebody's going to say, this is a game. That is absolutely for sure. But a game also has risk, right? A game also has risk and reward and narrative and payoff and climax and the crux moment that matters. And I think to me, being able to do those kind of things can possibly remove it if you don't cause a negative to sort of be in there as well. And it doesn't have to be a huge one, but sometimes, yeah, you can buy that extra point of dexterity. But what if you got a skill that nobody expected, like fucking speed reader, right? And so you show up and everybody's like, oh man, Carrick will get out of this because it's, yeah, sure, it's a fucking ramp filled with ice, but he's got a super high dexterity. And they'll be like, let's just ignore the fucking, you know, the puzzle because nobody can figure it out. And I'll be like, dude, I'm a speed reader too, man. And I've got a pretty high perception. Let me fucking try it. And suddenly the Carrick character isn't just the guy who can, you know, fucking pull off anything physically. Anyway, that's it for builds. I think it's important, man. I think that there's something going on there, and I can admit I'm coming into a lot of this stuff purposely obscure. And for a long time, I've been doing my own thing and not really following, you know, the big status quo stuff. And as I've gotten more and more into it, I saw some weird shit about Critical Role and, you know, where like a decision was made at the end of a story and people were up in arms. And I was like, up in arms? Really? Like, why? And they were up in arms about some dumbass shit where I was just like, seriously? And I brought that up. And I'm telling you, man, these are not small people in the industry. These are, you know, some game designers for role playing and stuff like that. Just absolutely fucking toxic about it. And they don't want to admit it. And I don't know if it's because of builds and it's because of these structured things everybody wants to use and everybody's accustomed to. And when anything goes the way they don't expect, they get pissy, unless it's about the theater part. But to me, that the ranginess, the RNG that exists in both builds physically as well as mentally is the juice. And yeah, I got to admit, I'll just say it here at the end as we wrap this up. ACNG, that's the hashtag. I won't say depression because I don't get depressed, but I will say disappointed. I've been highly disappointed with the interactions I've seen around role playing. A couple of my own, but really following a lot of my friends and a couple people who stream that I really like their games, where I feel like their games are just good, you know, for various reasons, and see them say something and watch the people, many times creators of the D&D games themselves or module writers or rules writers or huge creators on Twitch, really being toxic. And it's sad. It's actually really hurtful. You know, seeing that, I think for newcomers, I think it's really hurtful for newcomers. It's going to be very difficult to get people to engage in this stuff when they already see the extraordinary production levels that some of, you know, a Twitch game may have, and they expect that in their personal game. And then, you know, I get that there's social stuff that goes on in games and stuff like that, but one of the things I've noticed is, man, how dare you question anything or anybody? That's one of the major things I've noticed is I've seen people who will be like, I wonder why this on their Twitter to their own people. They're not even DMing anybody. They're not tweeting anybody, just on their own. They'll be like, I wonder about this. And fucking creators will just come in and be like, how dare you? You know, blah, blah, blah. It's just like, damn, it's insane. And I just want to say this is going to be a place where that's just not going to happen. You know, I'll tease and I'll joke and I'll certainly tell you what I dislike, but this should be a safe place to have a good time talking about role-playing and questioning what occurs and telling people what works for you and also asking questions about what doesn't work for you. And I'm going to fight it. I'm going to fight it forever, consistently. And I'm going to consistently talk about it, which I'm sure is going to get me a lot of enemies. I can already tell it's way worse than video games. I mean, it's so many levels worse than video games. It's mind-boggling. But I'm going to continue to talk about it because I think that there's a contingent out there of people who maybe have some questions about how things are done or want to do things a different way, want to adjust things and want to talk about it, and being shut down continually it's pretty negative, man. It's pretty upsetting for a lot of people. I mean, that's one of the reasons why we have some D&D, I guess, patrons in my patron that aren't really involved in the video games. They're just involved in, you know, the role playing itself. So anyway, that's it for me. I have a huge, just an awesome idea for a video for D&D. You guys may notice these aren't yet on YouTube. I'm going to give you guys a reason why. The podcasts were actually working out. The audio podcast made a tiny bit of money. It was the only place I really made money in doing anything I create other than huge reviews. Because the small reviews, usually I lose a ton of money because the amount of time is never commensurate with how much I make because I don't do ads. That's something I've bit off on. I'll talk about it, but it's not something I expected to change. Podcasts came along. And I was doing podcasts and they were doing really well financially. And what I mean by that is it would take me an hour to record. And whatever I got from the various different ads that played were commensurate with that hour, where I was like, okay, this is not just one more thing I'm throwing out there. And I don't want patrons to have to foot that bill. Like that's one of the reasons why you mentioned the patron multiple times, by the way. I know a lot of people be like, you know, this, you know, I can't believe it, blah, blah, blah. And it's like, no, man, sometimes a patron doesn't have the $5 or the $15, so they have to drop a level. If you have other people coming in all the time and you're growing your community, then that helps everybody because it takes the brunt off. And some people will accept the brunt that I think shouldn't, you know. Sometimes it's like, dude, you know, because I would say in the time I've been doing the patron, I've probably sponsored 70 people into the patron, meaning they were in the patron. They said, hey, I don't have the money for a month. This and this happened. I'm like, listen, stick around. I'll pay for your patron. We want you in there. And that's one of the reasons why it's mentioned. But I just think when we look at all this and you look at D&D and you look at all this kind of stuff, the podcasts were doing well. And they weren't about video games. They were actually doing really good. And then they removed all my ads, every one of them. I was getting ads like the Dickens when I started. And these ads were self-inserted. They were inserted by the system. And man, they died. Now, we know one time they died because Takedown and I did a banter files and he said some stuff that was unacceptable, you know, to the ad people. I didn't find it unacceptable, but And in fact, it wasn't even really crazy, but he said it, boom, got some ads dropped. No big deal. The major ones stuck around, but they're gone. And they're not coming back. In fact, I've emailed a couple times and been like, so what's going on here? Like, nope, we refuse to, we're not going to put any ads on your videos or on your audio. So for the longest amount of time, I was just doing audio. As this has continued, I have looked into doing video and I have a very cool idea that does not require a shit ton, but it has to do with D&D. And I think it's really cool. I'm just checking. I'm doing some behind the scenes stuff. I'm testing a couple uploads. Hopefully you won't get any alerts on these to see copyright rules and stuff. Not that, you know, there's anything crazy going on, but you know, the occasional time where there's a movie snippet or a GIF, you know, I want to make sure that that's acceptable. They'll be short, but I think people will fucking dig them. I've never, ever in my life seen these done. That's no lie. I was looking at this idea. I was talking to somebody. I'm like, dude, has this ever been done anywhere? And they're like, no, I've never seen, there's no other person doing this on YouTube or on Twitch. So I'm really excited for that. And you should see it in the next couple of days. I'm also excited for, it's an NDA game, so I can't talk about it, but there'll be a video tomorrow, today being Thursday. There'll be a video tomorrow on a game, and we're getting back into reviews. Anyway, ACGND, hashtag, man, I just want to say thanks from the bottom of my heart. This has been a weird time. Wife's got COVID, car got trashed, dog died. It's country song in my life right now, so I took about week two off. Had some really weird stuff going on behind the scenes as well. So I was like, you know what? I'm going to take a week off, take 2 weeks off. Not necessarily not doing videos because I uploaded one or two, but really just sort of separating a bit. But I'm getting back in there and I hope you join me. And it's unfortunate because I had just started getting this podcast going, but my hopes is people like it and spread the word. And I mean, spread it, guys. It absolutely helps if you do because there's no support other than you guys. Anyway, that's it for me. Peace out. Have an awesome time. Make sure to check the other videos, subscribe, all that. Love ya. Bye-bye.